G'day, expats, and welcome to episode 9 of Expat Chat. How's things back in Oz, James?
They're pretty good today. I won't rub it in, but it's about a 28 degree day. Looking at the ocean, there's not too much wind either, so very lucky on the Gold Coast. Obviously, okay. The fires are still around. They're still wreaking havoc down south, but there's been a bit of relief as well recently.
Good to see. I think everyone overseas has been following it very carefully and makes you realise how far you're away when you see these pretty disastrous looking videos and news reports coming through.
Yeah, that's right. It's obviously terrible what's been going on, and they are still predicting that it's going to get worse. But obviously, I digress. Let's talk about today's episode, Brett. So on the agenda today, I want to touch base on just a recent update about the main residence exemption. I suppose how an expat should structure their property or properties when they head overseas, and that's mainly looking from a cash flow point of view as well as a bit of a tax cash flow point of view. And then lastly, you know, superannuation 101 for expats, so what they need to know, structuring those sort of things that they need to pay attention to. And now, before we sort of move on, we should probably do that disclaimer.
Yes, all the information you hear is not just from the benefit of your earlobes. Information is for entertainment purposes only and certainly should not be construed as personal financial advice.
That's right. Now, let's move straight into it. The main residence exemption. I mean, we've talked plenty about this already, and obviously I think, this week's a very important week for expats, and obviously you know why.
Yeah, look, it's all coming to a head pretty quickly. It's gone from a lot of debate and a lot of conjecture to it's now on both the daily order of business for both the House of Reps and the Senate. And that will be kicking off tomorrow, Tuesday, the 26th of November at 12 p.m. A little bit suspect by the fact if, and we'll put these in the show notes, but when you do look at the calendar for the sitting of both the lower and upper house, they're going to bang this through as quick as they can go. So 12 noon, the House of Reps resumption of debate begins. Once again, the farcical name, the reducing pressure on housing affordability measures, e.g. how to rip off expats, is the first cab off the rank. So, and then straight after that, you've also got the Senate will be debating it. So obviously they need to pass through the House of Reps first, but if that gets through, and then you'll see the Senate. So theoretically, when we look at the timeframes, this could all be done by 2 p.m. Australia tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, when you read that and you see the order of business, and I do appreciate you just sent over to me, I would say it's actually quite unusual that you see those items on the same day at the exact same time, to be honest. I mean, I know you look at the order of business and then you look at the House of Representatives, it's essentially pretty much first up on Tuesday. And then you can see that when you look at the Senate, I suppose, itinerary, it's about third on the list. So if they vote it through straight away, it could get voted through straight tomorrow, which is very alarming.
Look, it is, and just for a bit of bedtime reading, the bill was sent to the Senate Standing Committee for the Scrutiny of Bills on the 13th of November, and they reviewed this bill back when it was originally presented back in 2018, and they still have a lot of concerns. I mean, I'm reading from them here. It says, the committee reiterates its long-standing concerns that provisions with retrospective application challenge a basic value of the rule of law, that in general law should only operate prospectively. And that's our whole issue. Our issue is not the fact that there's tax to be paid, or it's the retrospective nature of this going all the way back. And it's going to hit every expat who owns property as a form of PPR who, let's be honest, we do our best to communicate to Australian expats globally, but not everyone's going to know about this legislation going through. And let's say, for example, and I was thinking of this the other night, you've lived in a house for 10 years, you go overseas for 2 to 4 years, a short stint as far as expat numbers are concerned, and you thought, we can't move back into that house that we previously lived in because we've now got a bigger family or whatever reasons, or we're going to move to a different city. Let's sell that house and then buy another house, which on paper, there's nothing wrong with that. But guess what? Suddenly they get a trigger CGT all the way back for 15 years.
Yeah.
Because of you know, maybe they're trying to position themselves so that, you know, when they move back to Australia, they're moving into the house they want to move into rather than the former house, only because they did not know of these changes going through.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that we spoke the other day about the caveats that they've included now, the excluded foreign person, as well as the life events. And, you know, our understanding is obviously it's a preservation of capital in the event those terrible, I suppose, events occur. And then, I suppose, you know, terrible being terminal medical condition, a death or a divorce, separation.
Yep.
I think one of the comments that has been made as well is, you know, potential increase in compliance costs around this. And that's mainly because a lot of expats, they've bought these main residences under the assumption that they wouldn't need to know the original cost base for calculating capital gain in the future. So a lot of people are going to be scrambling to find the kind of evidence they need to sort of show, you know, the cost base, the capital gain, those sort of things, potential capital loss, who knows?
Look, and that's the I guess the farcical nature of this bill as well too. I'm just scrolling through the legislation because it's a lot of fun to do, and I actually remember in the explanatory bill, they actually said there will be little to no increase in compliance costs by foreign residents. It's just, gosh, you know, they just have no clue at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, like I said, when they reintroduced, they hadn't even updated the figures in terms of revenue this was going to raise. I was
copy
looking back
paste.
To the 2017 financial year. And it just seems lazy. I mean, obviously, to be fair and equitable, and I suppose reasonable, it would make sense that if they considered another amendment, any time that you've been a resident, you still benefit from that main residence exemption, you know, in terms of that way the legislation isn't so retrospective in nature and damaging, and therefore any period that sort of accrues whilst you're a non-resident, you know, that's when they introduce a new piece of legislation to sort of encompass that, which makes sense. So it's bizarre that they haven't really amended it at all. Just these little caveats, which are unlikely scenarios.
Yep, no, exactly. And I'll just tell all the listeners and followers and watchers, or depending on how you're consuming this, we'll be putting up a big post tomorrow, Tuesday, the 26th of November, on our website, and we'll be sharing it through the usual channels of Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter. So if you want to get real-time responses to what's going on here, by all means, please follow us on those channels. You can also go to our website, and there's a little notification bell at the top left-hand corner that says, do you want to receive notifications? If you hit allow to that, then what will actually happen is you'll get a pop-up on the screen when an article is released. So go to atlaswealth.com, hit allow, and then you will never miss a thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, we suspect that we'll have an update either by the end of the day or, you know, the day after when they release it formally to the public.
Yes.
So, you know, watch this space. It's obviously going to be on our socials, as Brett just said, but if you're unsure, feel free to contact us and then we'll talk you through the scenario and what can, you know, be the likely tax, I suppose, implications should you sell in the future after that proposed date. But let's move forward, because we've talked enough about the main residence exemption and our dislike for what's going to occur. But let's still focus on property. Property structuring in terms of, you know, if we move overseas, you know, having a positively geared property versus a negatively geared property, renting out that main residence. So I think first off, you know, let's talk about negative gearing versus positive gearing. What are they? So, I mean, negative gearing, that's a bit of a, I suppose, a clear one from our point of view. But Brett, what would, you know, be a case of how you treat negative gearing from a tax point of view?
Look, essentially, it's when your outgoings are greater than your incomings. So your expenses are greater than your income. And, you know, and I think where Australian expats really struggle with this is in the Australian psyche, we're all trained to pay down debt, you know, especially if it's your current or former principal place of residence for that exact reason. The problem we've got is when you become an expat, the tax status of that property changes. And so too does the legislation and the marginal tax rates surrounding your property. So, you know, while negative gearing can be appealing as a tax resident, when you become a non-tax resident, you know, you're still forking out money every year with the hope of building up tax credits. But, you know, it's a fine line to tread, and you really need to change caps when you jump on that plane to head overseas.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, negative gearing, you're spot on. In terms from a tax point of view, your taxable deductions are a lot higher than your net income. So you're still making that loss, I guess, on paper. Technically, you can carry forward losses, but you've really got to look at, you know, the likely impact of you coming home and using those losses again in some way, which people don't, you know, they don't really understand and they don't really account for. And then the other side is capital gains tax treatment. I mean, if it's just a normal investment property, you've never lived in it, then technically speaking, the capital gain that accrues or growth of that property changes for that period that you're a non-resident. You know, no longer access that discounted concession, the 50% CGT discount. And essentially, you know, expats should look at get a valuation on those properties when they leave. That way, you know,
you need those milestones, don't you? You need those milestone events. So, yeah, obviously when you bought the property, there's a valuation. That's worth a buck then. But certainly when you get on the plane, get another valuation, because what you're virtually doing is demarcating your time in Australia from a 50% capital gains discount point of view. You know, you bought the property for $500. It's now worth $700. Great. Mm-hmm. So on that $200,000 gain while you're a resident, you get that 50% discount. Whereas from $700, you know, when you get overseas for any other growth, you want to be able to make sure that you can very quickly on a bit of a napkin or an Excel spreadsheet work out what your potential liability is going to be just by demarcating those different milestones in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Just, and I mean, in the future, it's going to make your life a lot easier as well from a point of view when you might sell it and then you give those valuations to your accountant and then the accountant's got something to go off. And just be mindful, people, that historical valuations, they can be quite expensive. If you're getting a historical valuation on a property from 10 years ago when you first left Australia, that could cost you a few thousand dollars realistically. I've had to do one recently for a commercial property for a client. So it's better off getting them as close to when you leave. If you're overseas, that's fine. A few months ago, you know, you can engage plenty of firms to do it. And again, it's not a real estate agent that can do these. It has to be an accredited valuation firm that obviously has relevant accreditations, qualifications, and is listed on the registries as well.
It can't be an appraisal. I think that's where people sort of get a bit confused when they get an appraisal. They think, oh, it's worth this much. Well, no, it's not. You actually need a registered valuer to put his license on the line to say the property is worth X.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, plenty of people, they've used real estate agents in the past for those market appraisals, and it's not going to hold up against anything. When the HO looks at it, they'll just put it in the bin and go, where's the proper one? Where's the real one?
So, exactly right.
So, sorry, I was just going to say, most people, they might have a real estate friend that might give them a valuation which isn't technically accurate either.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. It's good to have those arm's length type transactions, because when you're, God forbid, you know, hauled up into the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, fighting the ATO, you need to have the courage of convictions that you're right, and, you know, making sure that everything's copacetic on the side of, you know, you've done the right thing, you know your numbers, there is no grey space, because it's that grey space that the ATO loves to work in.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, let's now look at positively geared property. Obviously, it's almost in the name. Your tax deductions are less than the net income or the income coming off the property. So therefore, usually when we're a non-resident, we're going to have a bit of tax to pay to the ATO, because our non-resident tax rates, you know, they kick in on the first net dollar at 32.5%. So generally means that you're paying almost one third of your net income to the ATO on that tax.
I think this is something that is the you know, a strategy that a lot of Australians, both in Dubai, Abu Dhabi, you know, Saudi, the Gulf region in general, struggle with, because they suddenly have surplus cash flow, and their mindset is to pay down debt. The problem is when they pay down debt, therefore their interest costs are reducing quite rapidly. Therefore their deductions are reducing quite rapidly while their income is staying the same and or increasing with any rental increases, and suddenly they don't realise that until the following year when they file their tax return that they're actually stung with quite a big bill, because suddenly they didn't realise that, you know, their expenses are way lower than the money coming in, which is great in nature, but the problem is they're paying tax at 32.5% on the first dollar. And it's if they just held off, certainly put that money aside, but held off from paying off the mortgage, they could achieve two things. They could reduce that tax liability by maintaining that mortgage, but putting money away as well to make the most of their time as an expat, and find that balancing act. And that's probably the most common conversation we're having here with, you know, expats in the Gulf right now, is how to find that optimum level where you're servicing your debt, you're putting money away, but you're not increasing your tax liability.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's why, I mean, a lot of expats, you know, they'll just, when they don't know what to do, they'll just throw their money in their offset account. You know, and obviously, as we know, as they throw more money into the offset account, the interest expense is going to reduce, yeah. and therefore the tax deductions, and therefore, you know, it's going to come to a day where we're going, you know, shit, we're paying actually quite a large tax bill now, and yep. we're not sort of seeking advice on ways to sort of optimize that, whether it's a case of pulling funds back out of the offset and doing something with it, or using the net income for something else, and you know, creating another tax deduction.
And it's so easily avoidable. That's the thing too. If it was a compulsory tax and everyone had to pay it, then say la vie. But you know, the fact that with a couple of simple little steps and a bit of guidance, you could completely avoid all these sort of complicating matters.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Now, I think expats also need to have a bit of an understanding of their loan structures as well. I mean, we briefly had obviously that conversation in that webinar with Jeremy Harper about the offset account versus a redraw. I mean, the redraw is still just the loan account. It's one account. You've just thrown more into the principal, which is great. But in principle, it can actually go against you when you want to pull funds out again to use for something else because the tax deduction changes on that.
Yep.
Offset is good. Offset is a separate account and therefore you can pull funds out. You can do what you want with it. Yes, the interest expense is going to go back up, but you can actually still claim the tax deduction on that as well.
Bingo.
So it's important to understand the distinction between the two because a lot of people assume that they can pull funds out of the redraw, use it again, and it's still just as tax effective when it's really not.
And I think also too, the amount of people who don't realise if they are in a positively geared fashion, the benefits of using a concessional contribution strategy into super,
yeah,
claiming the deduction as well too. You know, when I mention that to people, it's like I've just told them, you know, that you know, we live on a planet not called Earth. You know, it's amazing how that's like, what, I can actually do that? It's like, yeah. You can do that,
yeah.
You know, and
yeah, absolutely.
And done right and done and structured correctly, you can really manage those liabilities. So, yeah, look, I think you know, like we always say, and that's what we're doing. You know, expat chats and all the stuff we do. It's educating people about these simple little things. We're not talking about tax avoidance. You know, yeah. We're not for tax avoidance at all. But just simple little things can improve your financial well-being just by just being smart.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean that strategy. I mean. Easiest way to reduce your tax bill by 7.5%. So
yeah, that's right.
It's silly.
It's a big difference.
yeah, it's huge. I mean, if you've got a property portfolio that's, you know, paying $20,000 to $25,000 per year net income now, I mean, yeah, it's just
it's a no-brainer.
The fact that yeah, exactly right. Well, another item I want to talk about on the property side was depreciation because a lot of people aren't sort of or aware of depreciation. What is depreciation? Most people that have sort of bought an investment property, they might not have considered using depreciation before, but it's essentially, you know, as people say, when you buy a new car and you drive off a lot, oh, it's just gone down in value by, what, 10, 15% or whatever?
Yep.
So that decline in value, essentially. So essentially, if you go out and get a depreciation schedule, it's amortizing the decline of the building and over, you know, depending on the years, it can be up to 25, 30 years. And then there's different methods that accounts will use. Diminishing value, that'll give you the most upfront deductions over the first 10 years compared to the prime cost method, which essentially just equalises it out every year. Now, one thing that people aren't aware of is when you're renting out a main residence, you know, you can technically still use depreciation, but because it's your main residence, you naturally don't think to go out and get a depreciation schedule. At the moment, with the current main residence exemption and everything that's happening around that, a bit of a question mark on whether you would even get depreciation on this again. But depreciation is essentially, you know, it can be almost an easy tax-free sort of deduction from a, you know, reporting point of view. But you need to be careful now that this main residence exemption is coming through because if you sell your house and it's taxable, everything that you claim on the depreciation side will get added back to the cost base. And a lot of people aren't aware of that, but it's been an easy gimme for the last... ever since depreciation existed, but people aren't aware of it. So if you're unsure, definitely contact us and I can happily go through it all with you.
Yeah, look, it's just those little things done right, isn't it? You know, at the end of the day, we're not talking about rocket science here. We're just talking about, you know, basic fundamentals that any person investing in property should be aware of. Certainly there are complicating matters when you do become an Australian expat and no longer resident, but it's joining those dots and how does that work? And you know, there's still... Yeah, a lot of opportunity there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, property, it's not a bad investment. It's just all about structuring everything correctly and making sure it's set up correctly for you being a non-resident. Absolutely.
Definitely.
And another item that I wanted to mention And it mainly affects just your individuals that, you know, love this concept of land banking. And, you know, yep. if they're in the tax-free zones and they have this great cash flow coming through, they go out and buy land and go, oh, yeah, I'll develop it in 5-10 years, whatever it might be. So they recently enacted, and it got royal assent, this piece of legislation about limiting tax deductions around holding vacant land. 28th of October 2019, that's when it received royal assent, and it applies as of the 1st of July 2019. So if you're an individual that's holding a vacant land, but you've been claiming tax deductions on it, such as holding costs, council rates, interests related to the investment loan to get it, you can't actually claim those now as a tax deduction on your tax return. You know, if you're holding these sort of land items or vacant land properties through entities, that's a little bit different. It's mainly just applying to individuals at the moment. But people that have been sort of on the gravy train accruing these carry forward losses through that method can't do it anymore.
Yep.
So if you're holding vacant land and you're unaware of that, it's best to speak to your accountant urgently, because that strategy that can be somewhat of a common strategy with accountants, it's no longer relevant, to be honest, and you might need to look into what is.
Yeah, look, I think it's like everything. It's, you know, the government won't tell you about it. So yeah, it's up to you to have the initiative to know what you don't know. And go out and talk to someone about it, because, and then also find the right person to talk about it. You know, I think that's the, I've seen some, you know, topics going through recently which, you know, have really scared me with some of the feedback people have been getting from their accountants. So make sure that when you do talk to an accountant or a financial planner or a financial advisor, make sure they're match fit in the Australian expat space, because, you know, just because you got the title doesn't mean you know how these other complicating factors work, as opposed to just a standard tax resident.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I think we can both admit that finding a tax accountant that is non-resident specific is pretty hard, to be honest.
Yep.
I only know probably three. Yep. It's a specific niche. And as we always say, you don't want to sort of engage someone to find out what to do. You want to sort of, you know, engage someone that knows what they're doing already. They've got 50 to 100, 150, whatever, expat clients, and they understand what you're dealing with day in, day out.
Bingo. No, exactly right. And I think it's, you know, a good financial professional should save you time, not always save you money, but should save you time and get you the best outcome.
Yeah, that's right. And I suppose, yeah, in a sense, you know, tax structuring as well, save that bit of tax. The next item that I want to touch base on is just superannuation management, super 101 for expats, because I still have consults nowadays now that people are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of concern around super, whether you can do anything with it when you're an expat. You know, me being a non-resident, does that impact my ability to, you know, do anything with my super, contribute to it, log in, does that affect it? As well as, you know, self-managed super funds and those sort of things. I think there's always a bit of a grey area, and there's a lack of understanding of what can be done.
Well, I think, and it's probably the most widely held asset with Australian expats. And that's I think a lot of, you know, Australian expats who hold super, to me, they do one of three things incorrectly. Either apathy, they're like, oh, well, I can't touch it. You know, it's 20 years until I touch it. Set and forget. And they're the ones
that's the point.
Yeah, exactly. And they're the first ones who complain about fees and poor performance and all those sort of things. The second problem they do is they listen to people who don't have experience in the expat space. So, you know, setting up an SMSF before moving overseas, you know, is just the biggest no-go zone in super around. And then contributing to an SMSF while they're a non-resident, you know, which obviously breaches the active members test and off we go from there. So, you know, that's the third one. And the fourth one, the third one would have to be expats who, you know, to me, put too much faith either in information, you know, online in Facebook groups.
Yes.
You know, and I'm certainly more leaning towards US-based Australian expats here, but also to call centres. Now, just to give, you know, the listeners and the watchers, you know, a bit of 101, if you call a call centre for a super fund, you are not dealing with a financial professional. You're dealing with someone who has been trained to answer questions according to how the super fund wants you to answer. Certainly provide information. They have very little, I'd say, no, let's scrap that. They have no experience in expat work. Mm-hmm. And, correct. If you're not careful in what you say to them, you could have deemed to get an answer that you wanted to get, like insurance inside super. Is it valid if I'm overseas? Yeah, of course it is. They don't know that you're living overseas. They may just assume that you're on a work trip or on a holiday. So, I think, potentially super could and should be your largest asset in retirement. Mm-hmm. And it's the little things done now that get you the best results down the track. And this whole, I don't care about super, it's only a small amount. We had a conversation the other day with someone who had a balance of 100,000. Like, well, I don't care about it because I can't touch it anyway. And I said to him, if you saw $100,000 sitting on the ground, would you pick it up? And he's like, yeah, of course. And I said, well, it is. Pick it up. Yeah, you can't physically touch it, but, it's the little things done now. And it's amazing when you go through and review, super accounts for expats, just the, the lack of, understanding, but the lack of how the dots join from an expat's point of view, because, there's a lot of, mistruths, especially in the Gulf region about super. One of the best ones that goes around here is that you cannot contribute to super as an expat.
I imagine.
and surprise, surprise, that's been propagated by a lot of offshore advisors who want to steer across.
I was just going to say, tax-free wrapper, come this way. We'll do it in this investment bond. This is better. Yeah, I know.
Exactly. Yep. So, just want to go on the record to say, yes, you contribute to super. No, you can't contribute to SMSFs. So just want to put that on the record, because I feel like I'm repeating myself being here for the last 5 months, talking to people about that exact issue. It's there's a lot of misinformation. So certainly consolidating accounts, it's amazing how when you go through and look at the underlying costs, and just before off air, I was talking about a gentleman who's looking at coming across to him, $25,000 in fees we're going to save him by putting forward our recommendations. I mean, it's huge numbers. Yeah, it's a big balance super account, but also it's a lot of money. And it's just these little things that just, it takes a bit of effort. You got to get the statements together and fill a bit of paperwork in and do those sort of things. But it's not hard. You just need to give it that time of day, bit presence of mind. Okay, I'm going to smash this out. I'm going to get done now, and then I can relax.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, most people don't like dealing with super. I think the stats are that they usually seek advice on their superannuation maybe 5 years out from retirement. And by then it's a case where, okay, you've been lucky where you might have accrued a good balance. We can, you can restructure then, do some things then, or sometimes too little too late and you've got to throw in a large amount to get it up to the, scratch. So don't leave it to the last second where you're 3 years out of retirement and go, oh, I need some advice on what to do with my super, when 3 years, you look at the historical averages of the ASX, it's just not enough. But, it's important to sort of, you go, Brett.
I had a conversation a couple of months ago with a gentleman who'd been overseas. He was 55, been overseas for 20 years. So moved overseas, from Australia at 35. So his super balance wasn't big at all. And he virtually sought us out because he's like, okay, 10 years to retirement, I need to get serious. And when I just threw a couple of random numbers at him, he was floored about how much he has to put away for the next 10 years per year to get to his number he wants at retirement. And he's like, I didn't think it would be this hard. It's like, well, if you did this at 35, the number would be, one-fifth of what you're talking about now. But because you've left it for so long, and because of the complicating factors of, compounding interest and all those sort of things, you're going to have to do the heavy lifting rather than if you did it a while ago, your money does the heavy lifting for you.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I want to come back around to fees and taxes and those sort of things on super, because the self-managed super fund, that's a major one. And people need to understand that if the ATO deems you to be running a non-complying superannuation fund due to central management control rules or, breaching, essentially the active members test because you're a non-resident, then the ATO will tax you on half the balance as well as the income. So therefore, you're taxed at essentially 47%, obviously factoring in the Medicare levy as well, but you're losing half your balance and they give you 12 months to wrap it up or, wind it up. If you don't do that, which can be difficult, obviously, if you're holding property assets and those sort of things, then they'll hit you again. I think there was a case published last year where the members were lucky enough to receive relief from that because there was a terminal medical condition diagnosis, and one of the members was actually going to pass away within the next 12 months. So they said, okay, we won't do it. You've still got to wrap it up, but we won't tax you because we'll try and preserve that capital because we can see what you're about to go through. So just, you really need to be careful in the way those are structured.
Yeah, especially when people work very hard for their super balances. That's the thing that sort of gets me is, you know, virtually your personal exertion 9 to 5 is your super balance. So, yep. You know, you're working hard to get an income of which you get that money. Yeah, certainly, you know, treat it like gold and do the right thing by it. I think the fact that it's not out of sight, out of mind, but, you know, I think, you know, there is a bit of apathy that goes along with super. And, you know, certainly I think a lot of people also forget that when they do become an expat, that straight away, unless they're putting money aside, they're at a financial disadvantage to Australian citizens. Because Australian residents, they've got 9.5% every month going towards their super account. Whereas as an expat, it's up to you. You know, if you're not putting money aside, technically your colleague in Australia is getting ahead while you're going backwards.
Yeah, that's right. If you're not doing something to sort of prepare for your retirement or create that wealth on the side, if it's outside of super, then you're not really making the most of that time and that opportunity overseas. Obviously, career progression, those sort of things, but you're missing out a lot of opportunities there. But, I mean, that leads to another thing. You know, when individual expats head overseas, depending on where they're residing, they might get an end of service gratuity in your sort of realm now, provident funds, you know, Hong Kong, those sort of Asian areas. And a lot of people forget that you need to sort of look at what to do with those as well when you return.
Yeah, look, I mean, certainly bring forward rules, you know, contribution caps, all those sort of things. That's a big part of the conversation as to what you do with that lump sum.
Yes.
You know, it is tempting to go out and have some fun with it and, you know, go and buy a boat or you know, the fast car you've always wanted. But, you know, if you treat it like it's preserved, even though you can touch it, you know, you can get great results out of that, certainly in retirement, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people need to understand that, like what you just said, it needs to be treated for your retirement. And the rules are constantly changing with the ATO. I mean, most, I suppose, foreign pensions and those sort of things aren't treated like an ordinary sort of foreign super fund transfer anymore. I mean, now I think with UK pensions, obviously, we need to stay within those non-concessional contribution caps with applicable fund earnings. But most of the time, if you can withdraw that foreign super fund or foreign pension within 6 months of returning back to Australia, that's fine. That's a tax-free transaction, which is good. And then you've either got to look at ways of treating it for what it is. Let's, you know, throw it into super. Let's use the bring forward rules. Let's get it in there. Let's put in that environment, which is only tax concessionally, 15%, those sort of things. Or we use it, I suppose, as part of another retirement strategy. And that might be, you know, paying down debt or, you know, using a family trust sort of vehicle to put into some other investments and keep growing wealth in another sense.
I think that's probably a good point too to touch on. Probably one of the most commonly asked questions is 401k transfers to super.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
Yeah, shall we have a chat about that?
Yeah, let's go down that rabbit hole. Almost a labyrinth, actually, I should say.
Yeah, because it is a very commonly asked question, especially according to Google. You know, it's up there, and you know, obviously with the US being one of the most, you know, popular expat destinations for Australians.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's shocking actually how many Australians think that they can actually transfer their 401k straight into their super fund. I don't know where that's been published on Google or whatever, whoever's saying it out there, or it's just bizarre. I mean, they're completely different tax vehicles. There's no scenario that plays out where you can directly transfer a 401k, 403b, whatever you want to say, IRA, any form of IRA in the US directly into an Australian super fund. The ATO has plenty of income taxation rulings identifying what they are, and it's not treated as a foreign super fund at all. It's a tax-deferred account. Most of them are. Obviously, Roths are treated as a tax-free account depending on the distribution in the future and how old you are on the US side. But you will pay tax to the ATO on either that lump sum withdrawal or as an income stream. And then, you know, there's more that goes down into that in terms of right now, the common treatment of that kind of withdrawal is that most of your contributions, as well as the employer contributions, they're technically not taxable in the eyes of, I suppose, the ATO. They are technically taxable in the eyes of the IRS because it's all tax-free, But the ATO mainly only cares about the growth of that account. Doesn't matter if you've only been an Australian tax resident for 2 years, they care about the growth of that entire balance. They don't care about the fact that you've only been a tax resident for 6 months or whatever it might be. So a lot of people get hung up on that because they look at the foreign super fund transfer rules and they think, okay, well, you know, I've got 6 months to actually bring that over and it's, you know, it's a tax-free sort of transaction. But then it's not the case. I talked with an individual earlier in the year and he said, I just pulled out, I think it was just over 200,000, you know, withdraw it because he was leaving the US permanently. And I said, are you aware of the tax that you're going to pay to the IRS on that? And he said, what do you mean? And then it had a bit of an awkward long conversation, but I had to explain to him that it's a tax deferred account that you've just withdrawn from. Therefore, there's going to be a large amount of tax that needs to go to the IRS. And then I said, are you aware of how the ATO is going to treat that as well? He said, no, I thought it was tax-free because it's a foreign super fund. I said, well, it's not. And then, you know, send in the relevant, there's probably about 10 different income tax rulings.
Yeah.
And then he's sort of panicking going, okay, well, shit, what do I do? So in a way, there are ways that you can technically reduce your tax payable to the ATO. Now, the first thing that comes into mind is the DTA that exists. The double taxation agreement allows for these sort of things in terms of accounting for foreign tax credits, tax that you pay to another tax authority, and then you know you can make use of catch-up concessional contributions, those sort of strategies. So you know, you might not be as bad as they once were, but essentially the ATO does not treat them favourably at all.
And I think also too, when you know if you do decide to redeem a 401k, whether it's before you're 59 and a half or after,
yes,
also the country that you're resident in will have a big factor in terms of how much you pay into which jurisdiction.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I'll be honest, some accounts in Australia get it wrong still. I think I've spoken to another gentleman where he said, I think he was 51, but he'd been paying tax on the growth of his 401k each year, even though he was a normal Australian tax resident again. And I thought that was very unusual. It's almost like the reverse scenario of PFICs actually.
Yeah.
So when he told me that, I really questioned that, and I sort of introduced him to a few tax lawyers sort of just to get a bit more of an understanding of why the account's been doing that. But I haven't come across that before, to be honest. That was a very unusual situation.
Yeah, and look, that's what sort of comes back to before what we were saying before about working with people who know what they're talking about. You know, it makes all the difference because at the end of the day, you know, good advice, you know, should do you right, but bad advice, geez, it can cost you a lot of money.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that individual might have just been paying tax year to year, but he might not actually get the benefit of the fact that he's paid that tax when he withdraws it. I mean, the IRS isn't going to give him any relief for that retrospective tax that he's paid.
Nah, so they've just got to thank him, aren't they?
Yeah, well, that's right. And this is another thing that I tell people about 401k withdrawals. I mean, technically speaking, the IRS is not going to give you tax relief on tax that you paid to the ATO first on that withdrawal. It's not how it's not how it works. You know, it's meant to be taxed at source first. So if I'm pulling funds out in between January and June, I'm obviously going to pay tax to the ATO first because I'm an ordinary Australian tax resident. And then, you know, that's obviously US is calendar year. You know, we're half yearly financial years. So you've got to be mindful of the fact that if the IRS doesn't acknowledge the tax you paid to the ATO, you are going to get double tax. You know, you're going to pay a fair bit of tax. So, you know, you've got to be strategic. Look at the periods between July and December. That lines up perfectly with our own tax year and the US's tax year. It's just these key considerations, which if you don't think about them, you don't seek advice, can get you in a huge amount of strife.
Yeah, and timing, I think you hit the nail on the head before. Timing's everything. You know, where you do the redemption, whether it's in the US or back in Australia, the timing of the year you do the redemption, all those things just can have monumental differences in terms of your liabilities.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another good point you make because, I mean, technically someone that is still in the US and it's a new calendar year, January, but they've resigned from their job and, you know, they're not going to have any employment income and they're, say, 60, 61. You know, technically speaking, they could look at withdrawing an amount if they're going to be in the US for another few months and pay some tax to the IRS first because they still haven't returned to Australia. They haven't returned and become an ordinary Australian tax resident. And those scenarios where they're not returning to Australia straight away, they're just going to be an ordinary US tax resident still, you know, those can be favourable because you're only going to pay tax to the IRS. And then you can, you know, repatriate with those funds in a sensible manner and look at doing other things. But obviously always seek advice on that exact scenario because anything can play out.
Yeah, it's not hard just to pick up the phone or drop an email to someone to say, hey, look at doing this, you know, what's the go? Because it's usually people come to us after and they've gone, I've done this, I shouldn't have done it, what can I do to fix it? It's like, well, Atlas hasn't invented a time machine yet, so there's pretty much nothing you can do.
No, you can't really just roll it back in, to be honest. No. That's not how the IRS works. And as we know, the IRS, they love fining people. They love charging people. Over-disclosure is their mantra. That way, if there's any outliers year to year, they've got you. And I suppose that's probably alludes to that recent article that I published about the green card. And,
you know,
obviously the six-year rule, but it's, or the eight-year rule, I should say, but the six, it's really six, to be honest.
Pretty six, yeah. That's right.
So there's, I completely forgot about mentioning the 401ks, but I don't like to scare too many people, to be honest, Brent.
Look, I think it's that's what we're about here, isn't it? You know, it's just sort of being forewarned is forearmed, as they say, and I think with a lot of these things, you know, there's so much grey space and how all these different parts work, and you hit the nail on the head, you know, people assuming, and I use the word assuming, not knowing, that overseas saving schemes are considered as foreign pensions. Foreign super funds. You know, essentially from off the top of my head, there's only one that really classified as a foreign super fund, and that's the UK. Every other country, you know, if it's portable, would be considered as a non-concessional contribution.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, mainly if you're unsure and there's no clear tax determination or tax ruling which provides specific, I suppose, outlining of how it's treated, then you know, you can go through the process of, you know, submitting a private ruling to the ATO. You've got to give them a fair bit of documentation so they can provide an assessment. And, you know, the benefit in doing that is you're going to have clear guidance on how it should be treated. You know, you come across a lot of cases where, you know, UN pensions. A UN pension in most countries is usually tax-free. But in Australia, depending on the division and who you work for, it's not tax-free. It really depends on, I suppose, the specific division that you work for the UN. But, you know, then people need to look at, okay, I'm receiving an income stream. It's a great income stream each year because I've been working for the UN for 30 years. What's another route I can do to reduce that sort of taxable income now? And then that's when, you know, under-deducted purchase price deductions come into it, which, again, is a form of a private ruling.
Just a question on that UN pension scheme. Is it because if the division you're working for is registered as an NGO, a non-government organisation, like a, you know, what do you call it, a non-for-profit?
Yeah, no, yeah, you're pretty much spot on. And most countries usually signed up to those sort of schemes saying, yes, we'll allow that. But there are some which just won't, that aren't. And therefore, I mean, I've got a client who, you know, they're residing overseas, they're going to receive a UN pension, but based on the outlining on the actual UN pension website, the specific division says, unfortunately, it is still taxable as foreign sourced income in Australia. Yep. Which is unfortunate, but, you know, they're lucky enough to receive a great income stream from this as well. So it just takes some careful tax planning. So it's, you know, you're weighing up, you know, yes, pay some tax, but it's a great sort of income stream until you pass away.
Devil in the deep blue sea, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And it'd be good if you could just, or, you know, withdraw it in, it's treated favourably by the ATO, but it wouldn't be either as a lump sum because they don't recognise it as a foreign pension scheme or foreign super fund.
Yep, gotcha.
So it's just those careful considerations, I suppose. I know you mentioned, you briefly touched on insurance before, validity. And I think a great sort of example case study of this was client residing overseas. I suppose we've been through this with multiple clients, and it's a case where you've just got to ask the right questions. And, you know, we asked the right questions. They said, yes, you know, technically the insurance is valid for up to 3 years whilst they've been a non-resident. And then after that period, that's when you need to submit a request to either keep it valid or identify whether it is valid or not. And we went through that exact case. Client had been overseas for 10 years. They actually had on file that the individual was residing in another country. But when we actually assessed the insurance through the underwriter, they told us that it was invalid. So we were lucky enough to go through that lengthy process of providing a lot of documentation and getting a big refund for them, which was really great.
Oh, you actually got a refund?
Yeah, we did. We did. I think the refund was over $13,000 actually from previous years, but it wasn't a quick process. You know, it was a case where you'd submit the documentation they requested, they would go dark, you'd follow them up 3, 4, 5 times, still wouldn't hear from them, and then they'd pop up again like a meerkat saying, oh, we need this, and then they'd disappear. You'd ask them. They would never give you a case manager either, so you don't know who you're dealing with at the super fund. And all you had was essentially a reference, and you had to keep, you know, speaking to them and trying to find out what was going on. So we were quite lucky that they were able to obviously pay the refund into the designated super fund account, but just goes to show that it can happen. It's always worth assessing whether the insurance is valid and asking those right questions.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with the questions. I mean, you know, from memory, last time I looked at our question sheet that we, when we do talk to super funds, I think there's 35 different sections that we ask. And a lot of it, you know, we have to impress upon whoever we're talking to qualify those answers. You know, they'll give us an answer and then we'll go back and say, are you sure? And they'll go, oh, wait a minute. They'll come back. They'll go away and come back and give you a different answer.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, usually, when you're speaking to someone about the insurance, you want to speak directly to the underwriters or the person that's actually going to be on the assessor's team. And, you know, you go through the process of going, listen, they're a non-resident. This is actually the definition as per the tax, looking at it from a tax point of view. You know, can they still order a claim? And then even sometimes they've sort of got to put you on hold and speak to their manager and go through that process.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, it's every little dollar counts and we all work too hard for it these days for money to be frittered away, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right. And I suppose you already mentioned, I mean, the consolidation. It's shocking how many Australians have more than 5 super fund accounts and they just do nothing.
Yep.
We're taking on a client shortly. They've got 6. And sort of when you tally up all the individual fees, you're right, it adds up to being, you know, probably 3-4% of their balance, you know. And I suppose leading on to that, it's great that there's been legislation published about how they're reducing on the MySuper side, how super funds can only charge a certain percentage now of fees on the account balance. I think they've reduced it to 2-3%, which is still astronomical, but, at least that's all coming through. But it's just something that when you look at 5 super funds, 5 lots of admin fees, investment fees, MERs, managed expense ratio fees, and then insurance fees, it adds up.
I think usually what the killer is, there's always a minimum admin fee, you know, whether it's $300, $400, $500 per account. And that's the biggest thing that I, you know, talk to people about is if it was all just percentage-based fees, it wouldn't be such a big issue. But the fact that it's, you know, a minimum account, like if you've got 5 accounts, you know, and each account's got a minimum account keeping fee of $495 per annum, you know, that's $2,500 Aussie, you know, just there. Not to mention MERs and all those other bits and pieces that sort of do increase the cost of running a super fund.
Yeah, that's right, Brett. I mean, again, nail on the head. You know, people just, they can't sort of just apathy, not care about it, not think about it, out of sight, out of mind, those sort of things. They need to pay attention to their super because it's taxed incessantly over the lifetime. It's the longest investment we have as Australian citizens if we worked in Australia, and we need to be mindful of it.
Yep, definitely. So, look, I think before we go and confuse anyone any further, I think, you know, we've covered off on a fair bit today. we've always got lots to talk about and lots to update expats on. So let's wrap it up there. And thanks very much for the call today. And just to everyone, you know, guys, to keep informed, make sure you subscribe to our social media channels. Links in the description below and also in the show notes, certainly on our website, you know, and we have a look forward to seeing you on the next Expat Chat episode 10, going to double digits.
That's right, guys. Speak to you very soon. Obviously, don't feel free to submit your inquiries or put those comments on those YouTube channels as well so we can always come back to you.
Fantastic. Thanks, James.
Thanks, mate. Speak soon.
Take care.